Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Okay. That's a good idea. Adam Siegel joins us now, Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I guess, you know, before we talk about how big of a threat it is and so forth, I guess cyber warfare can be conducted a hell of a lot cheaper than can conventional warfare. And I guess in terms of causing problems for a nation can cause a tremendous amount of problems as well, right? Relatively speaking, bang for the buck a lot more.
That's right. I think that's the reason why it's so attractive to so many countries is that it is generally cheaper. As you said, you know, you just need some computer infrastructure, although people is a limitation. And you can cause some serious headaches for your neighbors or your enemies.
So when it comes to, I guess maybe we should take a step back and lay a foundation for this. How big of a threat is cyber attack to nations and corporations?
So I think it's important to kind of think about what the threat is. And so far, the threat has mainly been the theft of data, and in some cases, the disruption or destruction of that data. So for a corporation and for countries, the threat has really been a country getting into your networks and then stealing that data, in some cases encrypting that data, which is known as a ransomware attack. So somebody pays you the ransom. The larger threat, which we've only seen a very few times, is an attack that causes physical destruction in the real world. So an attack that causes something to spin out of control or blow up. And that is a risk, but it's not really the major risk.
So what is the major risk? Technology being stolen?
Yeah, I think, you know,
data
being stolen, and that's what we've been talking about the last kind of 2 weeks in the attacks that seem to be from Russia, known as the SolarWinds attacks, and then these attacks we've been talking about this week from China, seems to be the theft of data. So either commercial secrets or, you know, military or political secrets.
In terms of vulnerability, and you look at what happened in Texas with the weather and so forth, not that was a result of a hack or anything, but when it comes to utility grids, and we learned what MISO was, or MISO rather, as it relates to power in Louisiana and shedding power for different areas, because you got one place controlling all of it for a certain area. How vulnerable is that to cyber attack, where, for example, you could just cut off everybody's power? A bad actor could do that for ransom or for other reasons.
Yeah, so what we discovered is that the networks turned out to be pretty vulnerable, right? So even though power grids industrial control systems and other things like that shouldn't be connected to the internet. It turns out that a lot of them are, and they are vulnerable to attack. But it turns out that it is actually fairly hard to turn off the power, even if you can get into the network. So what happens is that there are lots of vulnerabilities, but control grids tend to be fairly decentralized, they tend to have lots and lots of different control systems on them. They tend to be older, so, you know, systems from the 80s and 90s. And so an attacker would have to have an understanding of lots and lots of different systems, be able to control them across, decentralized grids and other things like that. So while they all are vulnerable, it is harder to put all those things together. And so it would require a kind of nation-state attacker, somebody like Russia or China, to be able to put together lots of different things to create a physical outcome. Now, that shouldn't give us a lot of comfort, but it turns out that it's harder to do than it looks.
To make a low-tech analogy, though, is it kind of like once you get in to the facility, then you can find out where the keys to everything else are located? And is it that way when it comes to cyber attacks or hacking, that once you penetrate, for example, say, a power guidance system, I'm trying to think of the term, a distribution system, that then once you're in there, you can start monkeying around and figuring out how it works, et cetera?
But, again, because the systems are older and specialized, that it's not like I can get into your house and then figure out where the main power switch is. It's more I get in your house and it turns out that, oh, my God, you have things jerry-rigged in a really weird way. And it takes me a while to figure out how to do all of that. And quite honestly, what seems to happen with the major nation state players is that, you know, I'm in your house and you're in my house. So while the Russians and Chinese probably have mapped these power grids, we have to assume that the U.S. has done the same to them. And so there is a kind of mutually assured disruption going on where both sides are pretty unwilling to do that type of hack to each other because they know that the other side can do the same. Now, that doesn't seem to hold for stealing data. So that's why SolarWinds seems like such a big hack, because probably the U.S. is doing something very similar to the Russians. And so there doesn't seem to be any deterrence at that level below a kind of attack that would actually cause physical destruction.
There was an attack hack, whatever you want to call it, that the Pentagon was talking about just as recently as the last couple of days, right, last week?
I don't know about a power hack. There was probably the most recent attack.
No, not power. I'm talking about emails or something with the Pentagon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that the most recent attack is on Microsoft server exchanges. It seems to come from China, but that probably did not affect the Pentagon. It mostly seems to have affected smaller businesses and universities and things.
And this is the new norm, is it not?
It is. It seems to be part of any conflict, and it seems to be something that nation states do all the time to each other because they can and it's useful.
So when it comes to power grids, it's kind of like we're in each other's houses. We're looking at each other through the window, and we're each holding a delicate vase. Kind of like if you drop yours, I'll drop mine. Or actually, if you drop mine, I'll drop yours, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think with the power grid, that's right, because, again, there's kind of a sense that we can do that to each other. Now, that, again, it's not all that reassuring, right? It's kind of worrying that long-term we have that vulnerability. And for a country like Iran or North Korea, which is probably not susceptible to the same kind of logic or calculus of deterrence, then that's more worrying. Now, the North Koreans and the Iranians don't seem as capable in this space. There was an instance, for example, where the Iranians did get into a dam, but it was a dam, a very low dam that, you know, kind of controlled or local creek, not a, you know, a massive kind of threat to a lake or a river there.
Let me take a break. We come back, we're talking about Stuxnet. We'll take a step back and look at that and the consequences from that, how we've evolved or devolved, I guess, since then. And what are some of the things that we have to worry about as a nation? And is the major threat coming from Russia, China, somebody else? Cyber warfare, that's the new thing. That's what it's going to be. Not, I think, and Adam can comment on this when we come back as well, not boots and on the ground and tanks, because it's a lot cheaper to do it via cyberspace than it is to build and outfit an army, etc. Adam Siegel, Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to continue our conversation about how much of the future of warfare can be cyber warfare and how big of a threat are attacks from other countries and from other groups. And ultimately, it goes back to money and our 401ks, etc., and our financial security. We'll be back in a flash. WWL. 9:25, we like to take some time in a 9 o'clock hour and go into detail on some topics when we have a chance, and that's what we're doing today with Adam Siegel, Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, about the future of warfare and will it be cyber warfare, and we left at Stuxnet. Can you talk about that, please, Adam?
Sure. So Stuxnet was the combined U.S. and Israel attack on Iran's centrifuges nuclear program at Natanz. At the time, it was the most sophisticated cyber attack known. It managed to damage about 1,000 of Iran's centrifuges, and it was the first time that was known that a nation state launched an attack that caused physical destruction, so, you know, from the digital to the physical.
So how did it cause physical destruction? How do you do that? How do you, I can understand shutting down an operating system, but how do you actually destroy the physical assets?
So it was incredibly sophisticated. It managed to get into the system and speed up and slow down the spinning of the centrifuges, and okay. At the same time, it like in those bank heist movies where they interrupt the closed video and, you know, it looks like there's nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
It did the same thing. It sent a message to the operator saying everything's fine, don't worry.
So the
centrifuges span too quickly and too slowly and they blew up.
Wow, is that the only one, at least known, to have happened where there was actually physical damage as a result of a cyber attack?
So the other cases that we now know, the Russians turned off the power in Kiev in 2015 and 2016 in December. So you can imagine it was pretty cold. So Russian operators kind of flipping the switches and turning the power off. That came on back on in about 5 to 6 hours. Stuxnet is the only known case that, you know, kind of caused that destruction.
But that's not going to be the last one, is it?
I don't think
or
so.
The only one?
I think it, you know, the thing about Stuxnet, it was kind of a proof of concept. We had been talking about this being possible for a long time, and then it happened. But the other thing about Stuxnet was it was incredibly sophisticated and very hard to do. So, you know, the Iranians knew not to connect the internet, the centrifuges to the internet. So the U.S. and Israeli operators had to figure out a way to jump what's called an air gap, right? So they weren't connected. There was an air gap. The Stuxnet itself was designed only to work on one specific case. So it got out and spread around the world, but only caused destruction in this one case. So won't be the last time, but the bar was very high.
Should we be more worried about countries or individuals?
I'm more worried about countries. So, you know, in the movies, for example, like in Live Free or Die, you know, Die Hard 4, it's often an individual, right, in his basement, in the hoodie. But to cause physical destruction right now is still, that ability is still limited to nation states. So I'm more worried about countries. Now, individuals can still do lots of damage to my data. They can steal it. They can encrypt it. But if I'm worried about an attack, I'm more worried about a nation state.
And what is it that nation states have? Is it manpower? Is it the actual hardware itself?
It's a combination. It's manpower. It's a large number of teams to kind of be on the networks for a long time. It's intelligence. So, for example, with Stuxnet, the U.S. and Israel had a copy of the centrifuges and how they would operate because they had similar centrifuges from Libya. So the Libyan nuclear program is very similar to the Iranian nuclear program. And so they could set those up in the desert in Arizona and test over and over again. They also had code that they stole from operators in Taiwan. So they broke into offices. So there was a lot of kind of human intelligence and that was involved. That would be very hard for a kind of, terrorist organization to recreate.
So when it comes to the latest one, I guess Microsoft accusing China about the email cyber attacks, they say they're blaming a group called Hafnium. Is that, do I get that right?
That's right. The problem with the companies, they often come up with their own names. So Hafnium, there's a company called CrowdStrike that, always calls them Putter Panda or Cozy Bear, so there's lots of different names out there that are confusing.
So, but a company or an organization, as opposed to an individual, can they have the same power and be as big of a threat as a nation state?
I don't think so. This group, Hafnium, is probably nation state sponsored. So okay. What happens is, it's either a contractor. So the Chinese will often contract a group of companies or individuals and then give them some support, or they are, in fact, a hacking group that's either connected to the People's Liberation Army or the Ministry of State Security, which is Chinese intelligence.
So when it comes to discerning whether it's a nation state, a group, a nation state sponsored group, how hard is it to trace back whatever it is that was done to whomever it was that did it?
Yeah, it's increasingly not that hard to trace it back, but it's hard to then decide, is it, nation state, nation state supported, all those kind of lists that you went through. So a company like Microsoft or, CrowdStrike or FireEye, these other cybersecurity companies, they're pretty good at identifying, the infrastructure that's used, the techniques that the hackers use. There's some code that's often used and reused. Often they'll follow that, because the hackers themselves will sometimes make mistakes. They'll, forget to log out of their social media at the same time that they're doing the hacking, or they'll post other things. So they're pretty good at identifying the hackers that are behind it. But then when you get down to say, it's this group of hackers, they all work together. Here's a picture of him in his PLA hat. Then it becomes harder to say, are they doing this in their spare time? What type of level of support do they have? That often you need to rely on kind of U.S. intelligence capabilities. And we can see that when the Department of Justice has indicted a number of these hacking groups or hackers, and then they can bring some more, signals intelligence or, listening to phone calls or other things to bear. But in the end, it's that extremely concrete saying, this group is operating under the authority of the People's Liberation Army. That's a little harder to do, but pretty confident that they can trace it back and say, It's China, and it's state-backed.
Let me take a break. We come back. Did you say that usually because somebody leaves their forgets to sign off of their social media account? Is that what you said before?
I did. Sometimes the Chinese hackers, you know, will have a what's called a Weibo account, which is kind of the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, or they may even be in Facebook sometimes, and then they are hacking and they kind of leave kind of traces that they can trace back to.
At that level, that's kind of like a professional golfer kind of kicking the ball with his toe, right? I mean, it just seems...
Exactly. It turns out that, you know, people do dumb things no matter what level they're at.
That's just amazes me. All right, we're talking about cyber warfare, cyber attack with Adam Siegel, director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. When we come back, we're going to talk about mutually assured disruption when it comes to countries dealing with one another. And what about militias or different factions within the country taking over the country? And then how do we know who we're dealing with? And then when it comes to a cyber attack, what do we know? How do you know when it crosses the line and then it's an act of war? And then from there, it spirals out of control. 9:35, 25 till 10, more when we return. Time now for traffic on WWL. 9:42, morning flying by on this Monday morning, March 8th. Newell Norman coming up in about 18 and a half minutes. We're talking with Adam Siegel, director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, about how much of the future of warfare can be cyber warfare. And before the break, Adam, we were talking about dumb things, a hacker at the highest level or a group doing something dumb like leaving their account open, and that's how they can be found out. But something else along those lines is they call it a USB drop attack. And can you explain what that is and how some people that are very smart can be duped into doing some very dumb things?
Sure. So one of the ways we know that hackers, in particular state-based hackers, have gotten into U.S. systems is you go to a conference, let's say a defense industry conference, and you leave a USB drive in the bathroom, or you drop it on the floor in the, you know, where the coffee is, with the assumption that, you know, people being both curious and generally wanting to help out will pick that USB up and then go home and put it and plug it into their computer to figure out what it is and whose it is. And so in one test on a college campus, something like 97% of the people who found that USB go home and stick it into their computer. We think this is how the Russians got into one of the most secure networks in the U.S. They basically put USBs in markets in Afghanistan and in Kabul, and people just went home and then plugged it in their computer. So for a while, the Pentagon had a no USB rule, and they basically, you know, super glued all the USB ports closed.
It just amazes me how something so high-tech can ultimately become so low-tech just to keep it from being compromised.
Well, because it's a people problem. You know, we often think of it as a technology problem, but it turns out that, you know, as they say, the problem is not in the computer, it's in the chair.
So, yes, exactly. So in terms of mutually assured disruption, back in the day, in the 60s, it was in the 70s, really up until the 80s, mutually assured destruction with nuclear missiles. And I guess to say it still is with nuclear weapons, but is there some type of mutually assured disruption understanding between nations? And what would have to happen for it to become an act of war?
Yeah, so that's, I think, one of the big kind of complications of cyberspace and conflict in cyberspace. I do think there is a kind of mutually assured disruption or deterrence of what we would call, you know, above an attack above the use of force or an armed attack. So something that actually caused physical destruction or death. But as we've been talking about, most attacks are not in that space. They're below that space. You know, they're either theft of data or knocking a computer offline or things like that, ransomware. So it's very hard to have any deterrence below that level. But I do think, you know, China, Russia, the United States know that if, for example, the Chinese were to turn off the power in Los Angeles because they were unhappy that the U.S. was, you know, sending a ship through the Taiwan Straits or in the South China Sea, that they know the U.S. would react. It's the type of thing that we would be able to attribute fairly quickly and we would react. But, you know, stealing data, spreading misinformation, all those things, it's much harder to design what the U.S. response would be.
When it comes to bigger threats to the United States, or biggest threat, is it Russia? Is it the United States? Is it Iran? Is it somebody that we're not even thinking about?
Typically the big four are China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. The most capable actor seems to be Russia, kind of the most talented hackers. China seems to be the most persistent. So they hack into lots and lots of things. The North Koreans, you know, tend to be very disruptive. So ransomware attacks, and if you remember several years ago, they, you know, attacked Sony because they didn't like that Seth Rogen, James Franco movie, The Assassin.
Once again, it comes down to people, right?
Exactly. And then Iran, mostly theft and some disruption. So those are, I would say, the big four. But a lot of these capabilities are spreading fairly quickly. Countries can buy them, you know, kind of in commercial markets, and they're developing them. So, you know, others will probably come along, but those are the ones I am most focused on.
Yeah, talk about that, if you will. What is it that keeps you up at night that has your particular attention and your level of concern?
Yeah, I mean, the things I'm most worried about are, we've certainly seen already a proliferation of ransomware attacks on hospitals and schools. So, you know, very hard for those smaller companies and entities to defend themselves. I guess I'm most worried about an attack that changes data, either in kind of healthcare records or financial records, and then basically says, we've done it, we're just not going to tell you what data we've changed. We're leaving it for you to figure it out. Now, the banks have some protections against that, but you can imagine it would be extremely disruptive. People would get very worried, and, you know, a lot of trust would be lost in institutions. I think, you know, I'm worried about the types of attacks that undermine trust as opposed to actually destroy things.
So that would look like making it seem as though, or it would appear as though you have no money in a bank when you go to check your balance, your 401k is drained, those kind of things.
Yeah, or we've changed the 401ks by, you know, plus or minus 100,000. We're just not going to tell you in how many accounts or to whose accounts. Go figure it out. So you can imagine that, you know, lots of people would be extremely worried. And, you know, the banks would then have to prove. I mean, how many people still get paper monthly statements that you could then say, look, here, this is what I had.
I'm raising my hand because I do for that exact reason.
So I just stopped mine, even though I know that I should keep mine going. Mm-hmm. But I've gotten so many emails saying, please move to, you know, fully electronic. So those are the types of things that, you know, could be incredibly disruptive.
So it's definitely a game of cat and mouse. Who's winning, the cat or the mouse?
Right now, the mouse. So, you know, because one of the other kind of characteristics people always talk about cyberspace is that the attacker almost always seems to have the advantage. And, you know, part of the reason we've been talking about it is just, you know, humans click on things they're not supposed to click on, or put USBs into their thing. Now, it's easier to get in, harder to do, you know, long-term damage. So it's easy for an attacker to get in. But then they have to, you know, remain invisible in the network. They have to take control. All those things are harder to do, but still not hard enough. Now, people are hoping that there will be technological changes that shift that balance to the defender. You know, so a lot of people talk about artificial intelligence or machine learning. But what we're seeing is attackers are also using those technologies. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that it will continue to be the attacker. The offense will continue to have the advantage for a while, and we will, for a long time, be playing defense. And so that's why, you know, after these big hacks, a lot of people talk about, look, we're never going to keep them out. We need to focus on, you know, resilience, making sure the networks still work, making sure we can bring them back on quickly if we need to.
And one more quick question. When you look at technology and how it's expanding exponentially, where are we in 5 years as far as this goes in the game of cat and mouse and protection and new systems, et cetera? What do you see? What are we going to be looking at 5 years from now?
Yeah, so everybody's been talking about the threat to Internet of Things devices, right? So, you know, we've certainly seen people hack, you know, baby monitors and other things in your home. But once we have more self-driving cars, once people have more and more devices in their homes connected, all of those unfortunately tend to be fairly vulnerable because the passwords aren't reset very often, or they come with passwords that are very easy to guess. So there's going to be a lot of vulnerability as we just, you know, adopt more things that at the time seem extremely convenient, but also because they're connected to the internet. And you know, as we move to 5G, which is going to bring us even, you know, greater speed and more connectivity, more vulnerabilities.
To the point of somebody in the right lane being able to hack into a self-driving car in the left lane and affect what happens?
You know, we're probably away from that, but you know, there have been plenty of people who have done, again, proof of concepts of hacking cars. And, you know, these are cars that are not as connected as they're going to be in 5 years. So, yes, those systems will be vulnerable to attacks.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate your time, Adam. Very interesting stuff, and I hope we get to talk to you again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You have a good week. Adam Segal, Siegel, Director of the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program, the Council on Foreign Relations. Quick break, then we'll find out what Newell Norman's got coming up for us today, Monday, March 8th, back in a flash, WWL.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.